Hello, I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And welcome to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
This week's episode has audio postcards from Peter Gizzi, Emily Toder and Hannah Sullivan. And live in the studio, our guests are Richard Scott and Jane Yeh.
This is Peter Gizzi. I'm going to read a poem I wrote last summer of 2017. It's one of the new poems that's going into the new and selected poems forthcoming from Carcanet. That I saw the light on Nonotuc Avenue. That every musical note is a flame, native in its own tongue. That between bread and ash there is fire. That the day swells in crests, that I found myself born into it with sirens and trucks going by out here in a poem. That there are other things that go into poems, like the pigeon, cobalt, dirty windows, sun. That I have seen skin in marble, eye in stone. That the information I carry is mostly bacterial, that I am a host. That the ghost of the text is unknown. That I live near an Air Force base and the sound in the sky is death. That sound, like old poetry, can kill us. That there are small things in the poem, paper clips, gauze, tater tots, and knives, that there can also be emptiness fanning out into breakfast rolls, macadam, stars, that I am hungry, that I seek knowledge of the ancient sycamore that also lives in the valley where I live, that I call to it, that there are airships overhead, that I live alone in my head, out here in a poem near a magical tree. That I saw the light on Nonotuc Avenue and heard the cry of a dove recede into a rustle, that its cry was quiet light falling into a coffin, that it altered me, that today the river is a camera obscura bending trees, that I sing this of metallic shimmer, sing the sky, the song, all of it, and wonder, if I am dying, would you come back for me?
We opened our show today with that audio postcard from Peter Gizzi. And now in the studio, let's see who we've got. Rachel.
In the studio with us today, we have Richard Scott and Jane Yeh. Richard Scott grew up in London and studied at the Royal College of Music and at Goldsmiths College. He has been a winner of the Wasafiri New Writing Prize, a Gerwood Arvon Poetry Mentee, and a member of the Poetry Trust Aldeburgh 8. His pamphlet Wound, published by Rialto, won the Michael Marks Poetry Award 2016, and his poem Crocodile won the 2017 Poetry London competition. And the fantastic Soho is his debut collection from Faber, which is out now.
It's really nice to be here. Thank you so much, Rachel. I'm going to read a poem. Museum. The unknown sculptor chose his marble well, birthing you from a glittering seam. These flecks of quartz, pure light illuminates your chest. It's late afternoon, the halls are empty, and I am tracing a finger across the hacks and pox, these disfigurations of time that tattoo your torso. Oh, my Kouros, my Apollo, you know firsthand, only handless, the vulnerability of queer bodies. How the earth does not value us. Yet you have survived decapitation, the severing of every limb, part castration, to be here, sun-stroked hero of the archaeological museum. I want to kiss your sites of amputation, these rough-hewn slices, these weathered absences. I want to run my tongue along the lashed small of your back, wet the hilt of your battle-toned ass. So, I do. Bending my head like a boyfriend towards the reliquary of your earth-scarred sternum, I kiss your chiseled flesh and find you warm, tasting of sand and lime, and trace my tongue down the line of your groin towards your injured sex. And there in the Hall of Marbles, I take you into my mouth and tongue your fractured shaft, the ravaged break of stone, your cut. Absence has not damaged your thrall. If this little of you is beauty, your entirety must have been blinding. For the longest time, people told me, I must change my life. But this is my life. This adoration of men, this worship of those whom the world has deemed broken. Just as you gave your body to the earth, so have I given mine to this, echoing voices, and I am already steps away. Looking back, I can see only the dazzling slope of your cheeks, your sandstone shoulder. A family surrounds you now, giggling, pointing, nodding. Oh, my unearthed God, they do not understand you, the narrative of your body, how you bore the darkness, the years of not being touched, your loneliness, which has been my loneliness.
Thank you, Richard. And joining Richard in the studio today is Jane Yeh, who was born in America but has been in the UK since 2001. She's had two books out here, Marabou with Carcanet in 2005 and The Ninjas, also with Carcanet in 2012. I'm very excited to hear that there's another book coming out in March next year, as yet untitled. Also, Jane was named one of the Next Generation Poets in 2014. She lives in London, and we're very pleased to have her with us in the studio. Jane, have you got a poem for us this morning?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. Discipline. The shape of a deer in silhouette, projected on a woman's dress, off with her arms, her head, the mark of a hoof in snow, superimposed on a high heel, a pool of milk. The lines converge and part like migrating birds. Her skirt is an hourglass filling up with stones. Her heart is a caveat. See how they run. If her foot points towards the past, it's called composition. Too much thinking spoils a fawn. Her secrets play on continuous loop, like a bee movie. On the reverse, a blank surface painted over, another girl blotted out.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. Readings from both of you. And we ask our poets to bring in a small item or a piece of text or what we call a talisman that might represent a part of their writing or their writing process or something that just means something to them that would lead us into talking about your poems. What did you bring for us, Richard?
I brought in this lovely little yellow pouch.
I thought it was going to be just a little yellow pouch. That would have been enough for me.
Sadly, sadly not. I brought a rock rose, or a desert rose, as they might be called. It's a kind of crystal that is formed in like arid, hot places, particularly when lakes and rivers get dried in the sun. It's a really, I don't know, it's really sort of special thing for me. Like my favourite poem is Vague Poem or Vaguely Loved Poem by Elizabeth Bishop, or one of my favourite poems. And the whole premise of the poem is that she goes around to a woman's house and the woman is trying to dig up these rock roses in the garden. And she's discussing crystallography and its laws and how they're formed. And then the two women go on to have a sexual encounter. And Elizabeth Bishop describes the woman's body like the rock rose, crystalline nipples, she says. And then the last line of the poem is, and that darker, even more accurate rose of sex. And it was really stunning to me when I read the poem because Elizabeth Bishop avoided discussion of homosexuality and her queerness, her career, but she'd written this unpublished poem which sort of addressed it full on, and it kind of just made me realise how queerness always finds a way to be expressed and how I wished she'd been comfortable enough in her lifetime to express it because it was such an amazing poem. But anyway, my friend Anna Selby, when she went to Tenerife, she found one and she brought it back for me because she knew I loved the poem. So now I'm like, I love my rock rose.
That's so special. Mm. There's been previous talk as well of Elizabeth Bishop and also crystals in the other podcast. Emily Berry was talking about crystals.
Oh, okay. Amazing. Oh, C.A. Conrad loves his crystals.
I think that was how we got talking about it, actually. They were talking about the sort of rituals that are composed through crystals, and that C.A. Conrad composes rituals with crystals. I don't know that much about it, but there's definitely a ritualistic element to it.
He does. He sort of puts these crystals into his body, which help him remember his partner who was murdered in a homophobic attack. So part of the crystals pass into his body. And he also tweeted on Twitter. I mean, you have to tweet on Twitter. He sent a tweet saying that any Americans who need to kind of cleanse Donald Trump from their system should try a rose quartz dildo, which he was offering at a reduced price on his website.
He was selling them.
Yeah.
I'm interested to buy a rose quartz dildo to cleanse Donald Trump from all of our systems.
There's going
to
be a rush on now. So this podcast,
I love the compactness and the history behind a stone like that as well. It feels like you talking about Bishop not being able to talk about her homosexuality and her queerness, and this kind of rock being formed out of like immense pressure, but also an aridity. Mm. It feels like very close to both her work and your work, I think.
That's really kind of you say that. I mean, I feel like I'm just touching it now to get a little bit more of its power. I feel a tremendous responsibility in all my poems to be openly queer, because so many people haven't been able to be. And I don't mean that in a kind of like, oh, I'm trying to be a voice for other people or something. I just feel like I'm incredibly lucky to live and privileged to live where I am and in this country and be surrounded by people who are not, you know, hating on me for being queer and openly queer. And I feel this privilege to just to use that and to talk about it. And hopefully saying what people felt they couldn't before, I guess.
There's something in your work as well that's not just queer in a sort of romantic love, but it's definitely gay sex as well. And I think that perhaps for all the sort of the way in which queer love is now sort of celebrated through things like gay marriage, that still there exists a kind of like taboo, I guess, about actually the mechanics of gay sex and the mechanics of the pleasure of gay sex. Mm-hmm. And I think that that there's no sort of not too much innuendo in your poems about those things. And I wonder if that's a sort of like, I mean, I find that like enormously refreshing about the work, that it doesn't feel like the need to romanticize which is also like fine, of course. But it feels like a kind of and also not like a disclosure that's meant to shock. It feels like a sort of profound honesty about that. Perhaps is that in reaction, do you think, about sort of
I guess that I use sex and awareness of gay bodies and adoration of gay bodies kind of as a symbol for protest, for the reasons that you're saying. Like, it's still oddly taboo and people rail against it, and whenever there is a discussion about homosexuality in the media or it always boils down to anal sex and a sort of puerile fascination with it. And I guess part of my poetry is talking about the beauty and also the reality of that. My dad is not a fan of my poetry. I mean, he's a nice man. He's just kind of old fashioned, and he read some of my poems once, and he was like, "Oh, well, these are just about sex." And I was like, "You've missed the point. Like, there is sex in them on the surface and stuff, and that is important, but it's everything else that is underneath sex. I mean, sex is one of our most important things, obviously, that happens all the time and will keep on happening. And I just want to normalize, but all maybe normalize is the wrong word. I want to illuminate and highlight, you know, the beauty and the difference in gay sex. And
I see almost a plea for mundanity as well. If you, in a poem like "Even If You Fuck Me All Vanilla In," where you're sort of just describing how gay sex will always be a protest, even if it's done in, you say, vaguely tender ways.
I guess the landscape of that poem and the shame poems in the book in particular, they're trying to sort of engage with the discourse, which is one of the dualities of a kind of a fight for gay rights and queer awareness, is this feeling that, things need to be relatively normalized and there should be equality and there absolutely should be equality. But of course, we also need to recognize difference and where we've come from. The poems on the whole try to reject the notion of gay pride, which, although an incredibly amazing institution which has done so much good work and continues to do so much good work in countries around the world, the poems also want to face gay shame and say, actually, we've come from a place of illegality, a place of being shamed, a punitive place, and we're different for that. We've gone through gay shame together. So there are those two veins sort of running and rubbing against each other, alongside each other in those poems.
There's a sort of mainstream acceptance of gay culture, and often appropriation of gay culture is often kind of the same or synonymous with or parallel to the erasure of gay radical history.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. We sort of like get from a point where, pride is no longer a protest. It's kind of corporation slogans in rainbow lettering. And of course, there's something magical about that. But actually, when it boils down to it, it becomes to do with capitalism and consumerism and corporations and the removal of the radical fight for identity, fight for equality and fight to be recognised for who we are.
Mm.
Jane, would you like to talk to us about your talisman and what you brought in for us today to lead us into talking about your poems?
Okay, so I brought in this little badge that is red and white and says spy on it in red letters. I found it in a vintage clothing store in Greenwich, like at least 10 or 12 years ago. And I just liked it because I guess someone once said, I guess after reading some of my poems, that I'm kind of like a spy in my poems, or that my poems have a lot of concealment in them or disguise. And I thought that was actually kind of really accurate, even though at the time I hadn't even thought of it myself, really. So, I guess in a funny way, it's like a contrast to what Richard was just saying. But and obviously, like, I really admire Richard's work and a lot of people's work who write about things that are autobiographical or about their emotions and things, like, in an honest way. But I guess to me, I've always sort of been the opposite. And like, a lot of my poems will be, what are called dramatic monologues, where I'm pretending to be another person who's speaking the poem.
Well, I found an interesting parallel between both of your poems while I was reading your collections sort of side by side. And it brought me to the idea of what you were talking about in your interview with the Poetry Extension with Natalia Anderson about your poetry, the poetry that you're writing now, as though you're a fiction writer who's writing poetry. Mm. And I've always thought of your poems as sort of miniature fictions that, for me, sort of feed into a contemporary weird fiction kind of genre, a kind of poetry that merges fantasy and almost sci-fi sometimes. And in your case, Richard, I feel like your poems sort of do the reverse. Like, you take very real experiences and you make them otherworldly and fantastical. So you've got these kind of, I feel like you're sort of doing similar things, but kind of in reverse. Like, you're both creating other worlds. But for you, Jane, the poems sort of begin as other worlds. And then for me anyway, they land in a sort of as an emotional impact. And Richard, you start with sort of an emotional baseline and then the poems become quite otherworldly. And I wonder if you could maybe both talk about the importance that you place on imagination in your poems and the otherworldly aspects.
Yeah, I like the spy as well. Like, just to come back to the talisman as well, because I think there's lots of like plural pronouns. There's lots of theys.
Oh, yeah.
And we's.
We.
Yeah. And it's like either you've sort of infiltrated these groups or you're reporting back on them. And they have kind of like the, at times, like the kind of clipped, officious tone of, even though they're like doing interesting things with image and stuff, they have a sort of a directness of almost like an official report or a...
Yeah.
Yeah. And so maybe like just that's a little aside on the spy thing. But yeah, imagination, that's what we were... Mm. Yeah.
I'm such a huge fan of Jane's poetry. I am really enamoured with the way that you use these kind of masks. And I think it's really... And being the kind of reader that I am, I'm looking at the masks that are being used in the poems, but also these really sort of emotive slippages in the masks as well. Like one of my favourite poems is Alchemy, where an unknown speaker is trying to figure out the secret to alchemy, and is in this flurry of like, oh, I've got beef heart, cow hearts here, and I've got, you know, sky charts and I'm crystals and I'm getting my alchemy ready. But then when we move into the second verse, it's really sort of painful, like, I'm up all night, I'm working, and I'm trying to get you to notice me. And suddenly the alchemy becomes almost like poetry in a way. And I love the sort of moving in and out of these sort of fantastical worlds.
Thank you so much. That's really obviously an honor to be praised like that. It's funny when, I didn't want to give the wrong impression before about your poems when I was saying that they're honest or have like, you know, kind of visible emotion in them, because one of the things that really impresses me about them is how actually they're like incredibly sort of imaginative and make use of image, and like Rachel said, kind of end up becoming quite fantasy filled. You know, it's not like you're just sitting there being like, oh, this is what happened to me when I was a child or whatever.
Well, both your books have an array of characters, your books and Richard's book, and these characters do come to sort of figure quite large. I think about the clown, or is it someone in a bear suit?
There's a bear, there's a crocodile, there's a clown, there's a fishmonger. Yeah, no, you're...
And Jane's got ninjas and robots
and many
androids,
girls, strange girls.
Yeah, alchemists, all sorts, yeah.
Yeah, princesses on their wedding day. Thank you so much, Jane. It's really like amazing of you to think about my poems like that. Like I think there's a very big difference between biographical honesty and poetic honesty, and obviously like trying to have, there's a kernel of there's always a kernel of truth in emotional or situational in my poems, but then after that I definitely try to attach something that's kind of concrete, like I'm really enamoured with My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun. I mean, who isn't? It's like a totally amazing poem. But like, she just uses the gun all the way through in this extraordinary way, and it becomes this massively loaded symbol. Like, she is the gun, and then, but as we move through the poem, the gun also can be, the gun could be kind of God's weapon, or it could be a kind of a wife or a companion to the speaker. And it's just this incredibly imaginative symbol. And I always strive to find things like guns. I mean, that's weird. Like, I mean, like crocodile, the way of talking about abuse by talking about a crocodile or a relationship with a father with a bear, I guess.
It's kind of, it's not conceit in the way that we might think of it, like in an ordinary sort of metaphysical way, a sort of sustained metaphor that's kind of, you know, like... You know, the fleas had a go at you and me, so let's do it. It's not that. It's finding a sort of image or something that can be sort of turned over and then turned over again. Yeah. And I think it's particularly with your the characters that you choose, like androids and things. I'm kind of interested in that. What's it in the Donna Haraway? Cyborg Manifesto, she talks about like cyborgism being like greedy for connection. And I think when you choose these kind of, and maybe it's because they set up the potential for like binary opposition. As if you choose an android, then of course it speaks immediately to sort of this supposed other, the human.
This really feels like it relates to your poem, The Android. It's like when the android is saying, I go and hang out at the bear bars, or I hang out with the bears. And that's lovely.
That part is autobiographical.
It's just this lovely yearn for tenderness and connection, like Jack was saying, and it's the slippage in the mask, which is a beautiful moment. Maybe I just like bears, so I just love that bit. But it's...
No, it's true. I mean, I think sometimes a lot of these things that I write about, like androids and ninjas and stuff, in a way, it's kind of like a way of writing about loneliness or like people that are kind of outsiders in some way. Or that sort of don't fit in. I don't know. I'm drawn to that as a subject.
Do you think there's... I can't resist the idea that a lot of these things might also be poets, that you're... particularly, I guess maybe that's just because of, like, operating in a social world or antisocial world of poetry and poets, that, like, that maybe... Has that ever occurred to you? Or is that just...
Actually, no, to be honest. Like, I can see what you mean, I guess, maybe. But I literally have never thought of that because I also never think about writing sort of, you know, poems about poetry or poems about other poets or whatever. So,
could we maybe hear the android poem?
Okay. Well, it's called On Being an Android, so that kind of is probably all the context you need, I think, maybe. On Being an Android. My positronic hair never grows an inch. It looks like hair, but it's made of wires. My brain doesn't look like a brain, but it doesn't matter. My friends think of me as reliable because I never get sick. My hands can be used to unscrew bolts and pull things from the oven. How I was made, equal parts mystery and on-off switches. Age 5, driving lessons, triathlon, med school, embroidery. Everyone says looks don't matter as long as you've got personality. My first crush was a Roomba I mistook for a person. Second crush, a person, but don't even go there. I could live in a cupboard, but where's the fun in that? The cat keeps me company whenever I cook. I don't need to eat food, but I like to practice anyway. It's easy to be lonely when all your friends are human. The cat laps at my meals, but then she's always hungry. In my dreams, I am charming and good at making small talk. There's no program for that as yet. Being human means the whole world is made for you like a cake. Being an android means you get some cake, but you can't eat it. I don't know how to flirt, so the bears at my local are teaching me. The lightning in my head means a brainstorm is coming. If I think hard enough about anything, my hair starts to curl. It's easy to predict the future when there's a timer in your neck. The instruction manual says my knee can be used as a utensil. Everyone admires my artificial skin, but nobody wants to touch it.
So lonely.
It's funny because I haven't thought about that poem in a long time, but around the time when, after my book came out, one of my friends, who's also a poet and critic, Stephanie Burt, she was teaching at, I guess, a summer camp, summer program for like trans preteens or genderqueer preteens. And she chose this poem to teach. And she said that a lot of the students, I guess, felt like they could really identify with it. And which I thought was really interesting because, of course, like that wasn't what I was thinking about per se when I wrote it. But I was also, you know, really pleased that it was something that they felt like they could relate to.
There's something that we might not be able to tell on the from the recording, but I think you possibly can, which is that the poem is roughly has a roughly even right hand margin, but it's also every line is a sentence that's end stopped. That's quite a feat actually to get like every sentence like hit it. It's very android.
Yeah, it's formally android.
Yeah, and I sort of wonder if like the form of that. And the music of it, if that's a sort of the way that sort of falls out, was that something you deliberately had in mind, or was this just a knack?
I was doing a number of poems at the time that had end stop lines like that, I guess, just as kind of an experiment. But I think like you're right in that it suits the voice of the android, obviously. And also, I guess another little bit that's the backstory for that poem is. I have two poems in that book that are kind of, you know, in a way loosely based on or thinking about the character Data from Star Trek Next Generation, who obviously is like this android and who is also obviously the best character from that TV show.
So.
He also does have a kind of like, I remember episodes in which his sort of like humanity was something being negotiated. And I always found them like deeply sad and poetic.
Mm.
They're always, that's the sort of moment where like, what's the captain's name? In that?
Oh, Picard.
Picard. Yeah. There'd be like at the end of the episode, Data would just be like zoning out, his eyes like flickering, and then like Picard would like walk out the room, and you could see that something sort of shifted in his mind, or he's like something profound about his own humanity had been brought into question.
Oh my God, I love this conversation so much. Just like all the episodes when they're on the holodeck and Picard's having to explain like Shakespeare to Data or something.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like he's not literally going to give him a horse for a kingdom or a kingdom for a horse.
I always think about this sort of like the suggestion in Next Generation that the holodeck was this thing that people would go and live out fantasies privately, but that no one like ever mentioned the idea that this might be used for more sort of like XXX activities, right? That this is not, I mean, do you think that bonking is allowed in the...
Well, Geordi...
I'm sure.
Yeah, I feel like Geordi was always going on sort of like random dates to kind of like...
Lots of them were always going on dates.
Do you know? Yeah, yeah. I feel like, I'm sure that some sort of X-rated stuff happened in the holodeck, right? I mean, it wasn't just Picard doing Shakespeare.
I feel like you need to do, since we were talking about sex before, you could do a gay sex on the holodeck poem.
Yeah. I would love to. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's a commission from the Faber podcast, please. And you can send it in as an audio postcard.
Or you can write it in the next 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Just form it.
I'll just get away.
Do you have a poem that's close to
gay sex on the holodeck? No, sadly I have. It's not androids in the holodeck. It's not something I've come across yet in my writing. But I was just thinking, like, as if I could love you any more, and then you start talking about Star Trek, Jane. You're amazing. I love Star Trek.
Yeah, so I like Next Generation.
Next Generation all the way.
That's my era.
Yeah.
Let's hear another poem.
Okay. I read Crocodile because Jane was really kindly talking about it. The poem kind of came from a really fun place. Like I heard Sarah Howe, the amazing Sarah Howe, give a reading, and she has a poem about a crocodile, and she was talking about how she did loads of research and she watched all these like croc attack videos on YouTube, and I just loved the image of Sarah Howe, who I think of as like, she's so sort of like refined and intelligent and
intellectual.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not doing her a disservice because I'm sure she, you know, gets up to loads of crazy stuff. Like, but I just
she's
the
big
idea...
into sci-fi actually.
Oh, she's big into sci-fi.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, I think I seem to remember telling me that.
That's amazing.
I think she would also have a lot to say about data and Next Generation.
We need an anthology of poems about data.
Oh, you totally do.
I hope I'm not making that up. We'll have to check. I'm pretty sure
she'll write in.
We'll find out.
So I loved the image of her like watching all these YouTube croc attack videos. So I kind of went home and did it myself and stayed up all night. You know, when you get into a sort of wormhole and, you know, you're watching croc attack videos and then suddenly you're watching, I don't know, like Destiny's Child B-sides from like the naughty, which, you know, great. But like, I watched a lot of croc attack videos, but the image of the crocodile and this crocodile or this death roll became something completely different from me, like using it as a kind of symbol. It became a way of like reclaiming a really sort of damaging situation, and a way of talking about abuse. Crocodile. I know how I will die then, in a death roll, scales to my cheek, claws sunk into my pale shoulders, water burning my throat like whiskey, the uncountable rows of yellowed teeth wringing my scalp, and in the heat of the thrashing river, he will press his white rawness into me like that man who held me from behind when I didn't know sex and gripped my mouth like a muzzle and unsheathed his anger, stubble grazing my neck. See, I have died already and somehow survived, hauled myself up from the river mud to taste blue air, though I was not the same. I was carrion bleeding into the silt.
And didn't I wear those wounds well? Pity me, the boy who cried, crocodile. I have these moments when I know I wanted it, asked for it even, to be special, to be scarred, wading along the river bank, feet in the brown flow, flirting with wildness, the green violence in the shallows. And I know he is swimming back to me, his horned body slipping through sediment and weed, for nothing ever really heals. He can smell the red meat of me, bait lighting up the river.
Thank you so much, both, for such an amazing, interesting conversation. Richard Scott's Soho is out now with Faber. Jane Yeh's new collection will be out in March from Carcanet, and you can go buy The Ninjas and Marabou at Carcanet now as well. Thank you so much, both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys, thank as you. Well.
I'm Emily, and this is my poem, Tetris. After we talked, I played Tetris, and I got my highest score ever. First, I got the orange one pointing to the left, and I put it down on its back. Then I got the purple one, and I stuck it in the angle the orange one had left. I filled up the row with the yellow box and the long skinny tower lying down, which felt stupid, but it worked. I got a green one, and I nestled it into the space that was left. That line disappeared. Then I set down the red one in the middle of nowhere. I put another red one on top, and next to it there was a perfect space for two greens to go. The greens are the mirror images of the reds. You have to wait for them to fall almost totally, and then nudge them underneath the other to fill the hole at the last second. At that point, I had a gap two squares wide, and a yellow box floated down, and I put it in the gap. Then I got a green one and I stuffed it into a hole next to what was left of another green one I had half destroyed. That line disappeared. For a while, I built everything up on two sides of a narrow column, and at one point I cheated and put a piece on hold so I could make the column taller. I took the easy way out and deferred the oblong pieces one after the next. I waited for a while like that for the skinny light blue bar, and when it came, I stuck it in the crevice and got the four lines in a row, so the game seemed to disappear. Immediately, I got the purple one, which is easy to put anywhere. Then came two greens in a row that I nested atop one another like before, which I always do. For a while, I just succeeded making the mosaic hole and obliterating the bottoms in big gushes. That was until I got the dark blue one and it was facing the wrong way, and afterwards another dark blue I laid down. I had put an undesirable one on hold, so I was sort of out of luck, and when the second dark blue dropped, I created an ugly void there was no way around. The pieces started to fall very fast after that. And after that, the mound of color was dotted with a bareness here and there. The bareness was black and textureless, and its splotches were irritating. And when it was raining pieces this quickly, I began to think of you. Some of them I was able to nest into others, but the pile was getting so high. At times I just stuffed them wherever, so the topmost lines went away and I felt a little better, but I never felt happy. I got a purple one, but I could not contort it in time, and it fell on the wrong side between a red one pointing down and a yellow cube, and I could never get rid of that cavity. After a bit of this, there was room for just one line, and the fall of the perfect orange came too fast to be properly handled, and I did not properly rotate it, and it fell wrong into the last layer. When I finally lost, I was relieved. Now I could concentrate on you fully.
That was an audio postcard from Emily Toder. I think that's a new poem. I don't think it's certainly not in Beachy Head. It might be from her new collection, Aging. But we're certainly very pleased to have it. I think there's a marvellous point when you start to listen to that poem and you think, oh, she's just going to tell us What happens in her game of Tetris?
I was wondering if she's writing the poem as she's actually playing a game of Tetris, like, because to memorize all those moves would be so hard. Or has she filmed herself playing the game of Tetris and then she's writing it down?
I wouldn't. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some research there. But I mean, the point is that it's just remorseless, isn't it? With the shapes. But then quite quickly, as soon as you've got into the rhythm of these shapes appearing and what she's doing, and you know, she's nesting them and putting them in crevices and trying to get rid of cavities and things. But you quite realise that quite quickly becomes a metaphor for something else. Mm. The consideration. The love poem, it's a conceit, isn't it?
And it's really hypnotic, the way she describes the pieces falling and how she arranges them. There's a kind of obsessive organising that's happening. And I feel like if you're talking about the poem as a metaphor for some kind of romantic love or problems in romantic love, this kind of diversionary tactic is really special and really illuminating. I'd never think of something like Tetris to describe a problem in a relationship, or it just feels so external to emotions.
Well, it's funny because it's almost like a process she has to go through before she can concentrate on the beloved fully. So there's, you know, at one point the game seems to disappear. And then it starts like raining these blocks and
colours. That's when you win Tetris. Is when it goes down.
Oh yeah, she gets four in a row.
It was so
funny
because as she was describing the blocks and how they were arranged and colours, and I'm such a sucker for big block colours in poems. I love it. I was thinking of the weather, and then when she talked about the blocks raining down, I was just sort of reminded again of her genius, that she could indicate something like that without actually saying it and then come to say it. That's something I've always loved about her poems. She seems to knit together her ideas in really indirect and then direct ways.
Mm. And there's always this sort of like they're always verging on humour, but there's something sort of like devastating at the same time. I mean,
dark kind of.
Yeah, she can't get rid of the cavity that she makes, and you just think, oh goodness, you know, like
feel really bad for her.
Yeah, and then she's relieved when she finally loses the game. That relief. I think that there's that she does that quite a lot in her other poems, where she's like encountering different shapes or.
It kind of also reminded me of those YouTube videos of gamers, and they talk about what they're doing as they're gaming. And I always think about those YouTubers and I think, what are you hiding? Like, how are you actually feeling right now as you're going through this like VR, you know, and shooting people or like building worlds? And it's like, maybe you're just devastated and in love.
There's something very lonely about filming yourself and talking to an imagined person while you spend hours on Minecraft or whatever.
And she taps into that.
Well, and also, but there's also the lovely in-joke of, like, knowing Tetris and knowing the little shapes and, like, having favourite shapes. And, like, the relief that comes when you don't have one of those sort of wiggly S1s.
She's either so good at Tetris or has never played Tetris.
I think she's a whiz. I think she's a master. Anyway, Rachel, what's our final audio postcard today?
We have an excerpt from The Sandpit After Rain, which is taken from Hannah Sullivan's Three Poems, published by Faber.
3. When the egg meets the whisk. If you do not weep now, you may never weep, because when you return, there will only be a cubicle and the nectarines on the hospital windowsill. Things slump, dirty themselves, become compound. Mould forms its spores on bread, and sheep get shaggier. Cherry blossom settles on cars like sunroofs. Jumpers bobble. You know all this. The look of meat minced or raw or browning in the pan. The newborn baby's eye like a poster of the Aegean. And how the iris tans, brindles, picks up its sunspot, spins colour like roulette. And yet, you always forget, like the sand from Petra, when the jar flies from the shelf, forgetting its lairs. Think of a children's sandpit after rain. Seaweed of twigs, blown Costa cups, a capsized sock, the filthy abandoned homes of snails, a spade. and beyond the sand the municipal grass, with its round fox turds and borrowed loose earth and pellets and the hairy scallion clumps that follow bluebells. Think of the discretion of a bluebell. Think of municipal grass. Think of your back at 20, a map of nothing, a Pacific, and then the colonies of pain, the trigger points, the knotty sheaths of fascia you pay people to pound, the balkanization of the muscle groups. Think of the reality of breastfeeding, your fingers gleaming like crab claws under the tap, the breast pump drying on its wrap, the lip valve missing, the full bottle tipping voluptuously into the carpet pile, the freezer with its little packs of frozen pastry, the baby alone in his basket, watching the shadows. And think of the pop like champagne, the first time you opened formula, the magnum bottle, the baby sick as a wedding guest, and then soft pillowed with his dummy on your breast. Think how suffering is unanimated, the iron filings of the laughter lines unmagnetized, blending with the bruises. What Crayola, what an Ash Wednesday for a face. Think of your father's leather valet case, the navy dressing gown you used to put your nose in. You hadn't seen them since childhood, and there they were by the side of the bed to take home. The leather with its evenly polished grain, the dressing gown mended on the shoulder. Think of a children's sandpit after rain.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and produced by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and Hannah Marshall for Faber and Faber.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can check out our other episodes and subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favourite podcasts.